Hi, everybody, and welcome to Mecha Dragon, a podcast about all the geeky and nerdy stuff you love, brought to you by Captain Geek and the Dark Nerd. I'm your Captain Will.
And I'm your nerd, Jess.
Today, we're talking about Captain Marvel. With us today is our distinguished guest, friend, and nerd extraordinaire, Jamie.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Jamie. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so today we're talking about Captain Marvel, and I want to get right into it. So why don't I start actually with a quick synopsis of the movie that is not spoilery. So why don't I just start with this quick synopsis. Veers is a member of the Kree Star Force, a group of elite warriors whose mission is to fight the sinister shape-shifting aliens known as Skrulls. When the conflict brings Veers to Earth circa 1995, without her Star Force comrades, she teams up with S.H.I.E.L.D. agent Nick Fury to stop the Skrulls from obtaining technology that would give them an advantage in the war. What she doesn't count on are the many secrets that her trip to Earth uncovers.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So this movie is directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. Screenplay by Anna Boden, Ryan Fleck, Geneva Robertson, Duare, and a whole bunch of people working on the story, including Nicole Perlman, who wrote the original Guardians of the Galaxy script. And by the way, I wanted to mention that this movie to date has made over $910 million at the worldwide box office.
Wow. Yeah, wow.
Crazy.
Which is pretty big. I mean, it's going to cross a billion.
I was seeing all sorts of videos. People aren't sure it's going to make it because the drop off from the first week to the second week and stuff.
Well, like, actually, I looked at the stats on that, and it had the second lowest drop-off out of any of the MCU movies. I think the one that had the least drop-off was the first Avengers movie.
Yep.
And this one has
the second.
It was like
54 or something, where the average is a 56% drop-off.
Something like that. And I think Avengers was like 50.4, you know, drop-off. Mm-hmm. And then Captain Marvel was, it was number two. I don't remember all those numbers exactly. But so I just wanted to bring that up because there has been a lot of criticism about this movie, which I think a lot of it is, you know, butthurt male trolls on. Yeah, a bunch of malarkey, perhaps, is what you might say. But I want to be clear that I don't think that if you dislike this movie, that necessarily makes you like a sexist or a bad person. You know, it's all very subjective, but I think a lot of that backlash that you saw online is basically trolls, just to put it as simply as I can. So anyway, with all of that said, why don't we just jump into like your general impressions of the movie? And I would like to start off with our guest giving us her general impressions, because I believe you also saw this movie yesterday, right?
Yeah, I did. Fun okay. fact so about I enjoyed it. Some of the things I like about it are things that we have actually talked about with as sort of criticisms with other superhero films, just in passing, clearly not you and me on your podcast. yeah. Some of the Avengers movies got to the point where it was like joke, 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 and kind of maybe losing a little bit of heart. Mm-hmm. I don't think this movie did the heartfelt moments quite as well as maybe Wonder Woman did, but I will say that I appreciated the fact that the movie had a sense of humor, but it also had a heart, and it wasn't afraid to give time to let those moments play out and happen. Mm. And I think for what it's worth, like, I feel like I see that more in female-led superhero films than I am in sort of the ensemble-driven. I take that back. Like, Ant-Man and the Wasp kind of had some of those moments, had some really sweet moments like that. But I think maybe we're tending to trend more now towards like letting you feel with these characters versus just it being like a good time buddy film, you know?
I love that observation. And I think that that might have a lot to do with the directors that they chose for this film, Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, who are basically indie filmmakers, or, you know, were before this. And I don't, did either of you see their film Half Nelson that they did in 2006? So that is a fantastic movie that you guys should check out. So that's just a side comment. So I really have to agree with you, Jamie. The way I've been describing this movie to people is I think it was a good movie. I really did enjoy it, and there's a lot of stuff we can get into talking about that. It didn't necessarily rise to the level of a great movie for me. It did not rise to that level for me, but I still really enjoyed it. But I also think that this movie's story was one of the better stories in the MCU.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the entire movie as a whole didn't rise to a certain level of greatness, but I felt like that the story did have a lot of heart, and there was actually more to it than meets the eye at first glance, in my opinion.
Right.
Those are my sort of general thoughts. Jess, what were your general impressions?
I also liked it. I thought it was a lot of fun. You know, the character building and the story, her origin, all that. Was a lot of fun to explore because I wasn't real familiar with Captain Marvel before, and you know her dealing with Fury and how, you know, all the pieces you start to see from all the other movies start falling together. You know, that was a good thing in the movie for me. Mm-hmm. I like you said, it was a good movie. It wasn't a great movie. It's like when I saw it, my brother's like, "Hey, was it Infinity War good?" And I was like, "No." Not at all.
Well, Infinity War is also a completely different kind of movie. Like,
right.
Very ensemble driven. Anyways, please continue.
Yeah, no, it was cool when they went back to the 90s. Spoiler alert. And seeing how they mixed all that in with, you know, the grunge clothing and the music and stuff. And,
yeah, the 90s thing is not a spoiler, by the way, because that was very clear in the in the trailers. Yeah.
It says that in the synopsis, it's like it starts out like set in the 90s. So you're not ruining anything with that one.
right.
Yeah, if you haven't figured that out yet.
You did mention how it was tying in with the MCU. I think that's kind of what you're getting at when you were saying how things were starting to connect.
Yeah, and you see throughout the movie, a lot of those are spoiler alerts, all the how they tie in this and how they tie in that, and that actually made it more enjoyable to watch overall because it brings in all that stuff that you are wondering about from all the other movies the past 10 years or so.
I agree. So, I mean, I don't know that it necessarily tied into every single
not all,
one of the MCU movies, right? But it did tie into several of them, and obviously the Nick Fury is in it, a younger Nick Fury, and you know, there's a couple other things that we're not going to get to until the spoilers part of the conversation, but I did enjoy mm-hmm. that part. I thought it was really a fun sci-fi space adventure with a hunk of 90s buddy cop action movie thrown in, which I thought was a really interesting combination. It'd be kind of like if, you know, aliens came down in the middle of a Die Hard movie, basically, in a way. So, like, Jamie, what did you think about the acting in this movie?
You know, I liked it in general. Brie Larson reminds me of Keira Knightley, but she's not afraid to unlock her jaw when she talks. Her mouth moves.
Sorry. I knew you were going to be a great guest.
okay. Yeah, I mean, I really liked it. I thought it was interesting how they sort of made Nick Fury and Jim Coulson look a little younger because they are.
Oh my God, the CGI on Samuel L. Jackson was amazing.
You couldn't tell, honestly. Like, he looks great anyway, you couldn't tell.
Coulson, and like, during the movie, I was not thinking about it, which is what made it so good, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what did you say about Coulson?
I said you could tell a little bit with him, but not really, like, compared to where, like, some of the CGI mm-hmm. we've seen on, like, Tron and Star Wars and things like that, where they're making these characters look younger or putting in people who are dead, actually dead.
Oh, we've come a long way since Tron.
Yeah.
Coulson, too, Coulson's got a baby face, you know?
Yeah, he does.
He does, but if you look at him now, like, he was on a couple interviews recently, like, with Nerdist, where he was on camera recently. I mean, and you can really tell. I mean, just looking at Coulson in like the trailer, for example, because they do show a shot of him in the trailer, and like that's just how he looks, and you don't even think that much of it, But then when you actually see him now, because it how long has it been since he first appeared in Thor or whatever movie he was in first, right?
Right.
I guess he was in Iron Man. He was in the first Iron Man movie.
Yeah.
I mean, he does look a lot closer to how he was in Iron Man, but a little bit younger, right? About 10 years younger-ish.
Yeah.
But if you look at him now, man, you can see the difference. And he does, yeah. I guess, have a little of a baby face, but, like, it just goes to show how effective they've gotten that technology now, in my right. opinion.
Yeah, I'd have to see him side by side, but, you know, Samuel L. Jackson, he look younger for sure.
I have
almost
seen...
back from his Pulp Fiction days.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was right around that era.
Yeah.
Wasn't Pulp Fiction like 94?
Yeah, 94 or something. Yeah.
So with regards to the acting, okay, I have seen a lot of reviews where people were knocking Brie Larson's performance, her acting in the movie. Some people called it wooden and this and that, but I really don't agree with that. I don't either.
I don't agree with it.
I would have liked them to give her like another scene with some more like meaty acting stuff to do, just because I know how good she is. I mean, have you guys seen the movie Room?
Yeah.
I have not.
Wow.
But I heard it was fantastic.
I mean,
and, you know, she got all sorts of accolades.
She deserved the Oscar that she won for that movie. I mean, she really did. In any case, I would have liked to see more of her like really getting into character in that movie, but you know, I think she did really well. Jamie, what are your thoughts on that?
I think she did really well too. What I think is, like, it's little moments with her in that movie, right? Like, she's not over the top acting. It's like a little side smirk to the camera, or like it's all done in glances. And again, like, so I think why I liked it too is some of these superhero movies, things can be over the top, you know. It's a comic book, why wouldn't you be? But you know, that her character's going through a lot. She's, you know, on a bit of a, without a spoiler, on a bit of a self-discovery through this thing. And my point of view was, like, I just felt like I was a little bit with her, where she's kind of outside of her life, taking it in and reacting to it versus, you know, versus being 100% controlled by things that are going on around her. And for that thing, I think she did a good job, and I kind of, whether that was her choice or not, that's how I perceived it. But I sort of appreciated it a little more than maybe just rolling with the punches and reacting to every single thing. I enjoyed sort of the subtlety of it.
I enjoyed the subtlety of it too. And I'm going to ask Jesse what you think in a second, but I think she created a character in a very subtle way that was very like snarky, but also kind of closed off.
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of that comes from things that we can't get into in the non-spoilery discussion, but like I felt like she was the type of person who she doesn't let people see her sweat, so to speak, right? Like never let them see you bleed. Like that's something that I learned on the playground, because as a kid, I'll tell you what, I was a big dork, and you know, I got picked on a lot. And you learn to like not let people see you like uncomfortable and vulnerable, basically. And I think that was a, to me, that was a part of her character. Like, that was part of who she was, which maybe came out of the fact that she was very much a woman in a man's world, in the sense that, you know, she was, well, just going from the beginning of the movie, I mean, she's this warrior in this group, but then you also know from the trailer, mind you, so this is not a big spoiler, that she was an Air Force pilot in the United States military. And at the time in the 90s, you know, they were not letting women fly combat missions and things like that. And, you know, it's always been a male-dominated sort of place. So, you know, it just made me think, well, maybe that was part of the reason that that's the type of character that she is.
I agree. And without getting into any of the revealing anything, I think once they start revealing little bits of her background, you would understand why she would be that way as well, you know.
Yes.
Having to like,
yes,
sit under her emotions a little bit and not play her hand, and everything needs to be more subtle for her.
Absolutely. And on the note of acting, before we get to Jess, Ben Mendelsohn as the lead Skrull, amazing.
So good.
What did you think about the acting, Jess?
I thought you guys basically nailed everything I was gonna say and added some. But, you know, with the whole spoiler thing, the way the story unfolds for her, you know, she's just meeting all these people, and she doesn't know what's going on and this and that, so she's kind of learning as she goes. So that could be another reason why she's not too flamboyant, you know, with her personality and stuff, and kind of more reserved. But
yeah,
that stuff we can unfold more in the spoiler review. But I had no qualms, you know. You know, when you see an actor being wooden or anything, you can tell. But no, she felt comfortable in the role. She was great. And like Ben Mendelsohn, you mentioned him. He was good.
He's so good.
The one guy. I don't know. Who played the one Skrull guy? I got to look him up. But I liked him.
The other Skrull guy that was with Ben Mendelsohn's character a lot of the time. Yeah. He was good. I feel like he must be. I got to look up who that is, because I feel like he is a comic actor that I recognized under all that makeup somehow.
Yeah, it's like the voice. Up. It's like, where's that voice? And then Sam Jackson is Sam Jackson.
Yeah, Sam Jackson. He's always great. I mean, he's always great, but he was also a younger version of Nick Fury, who hadn't quite faced a lot of the challenges that, you know, Fury ends up facing in his life quite yet. You know?
Yeah, it was just a beat cop, basically.
So I thought that was really interesting. Okay, so, all right, so we've talked about the acting. So let's just talk in a non-spoilery way real quick about all the 90s references. I don't want to give them away, but I will say that, like, I did really enjoy the soundtrack that they used from the 90s. And I thought that, for the most part, it was utilized really well. And there's also, I don't actually know how much we can say about these without spoiling anything, but there's like a couple like 90s technology references in there that just I thought were hilarious.
Yeah.
Right.
I agree too. I mean, I don't think this spoils anything. Like, it was very 90s. There's a pagers used. You know, like, I thought that
right,
was like,
right.
There's we didn't have cell phones back in the early 90s.
You know? Right, right. No. And I believe he called it state of the art.
It was probably a $300 pager, you know.
Right. So is there any other sort of general non-spoilery things that you wanted to talk about, either of you?
I mean, the thing I mentioned to you when we were leading up to it, I think that kind of gets into specifics, but I think it's a conversation that we can have without doing any spoilers, okay. Per se. But I don't know if that's what you mean by general, or if that's kind of a specific thing.
What's the topic again for this?
So one, it's really kind of like what I'm noticing sort of in a trend, especially with some of these superhero films. And then a choice they made when writing this film that I think is kind of telling.
It sounds like it might actually be spoilery, so why don't we save that one?
Okay.
I just had one more note.
Did it? Real quick, Jamie, did it have anything to do with like all the controversy and stuff around the film?
I don't know. I didn't look up any of it. I didn't read anything going into this film. I didn't read a single review.
Sweet. Nice. Well, you'll learn some stuff. But yeah, we can do all the controversy stuff after our spoiler or during.
We'll talk about it in a minute. Okay, so just one last point that I wanted to make before we get into spoilers and stuff is like. So I've seen a lot of reviews saying that there was no tension in the movie because Carol was like so powerful and she was never in danger. But I think actually a lot of that comes from people's foreknowledge of the character in the film. Like, there's been so much hype and she has such a long history in the comics, and a lot of that information made its way into the marketing and YouTubers doing their videos and stuff. To people who weren't necessarily big comic book fans. And so I actually think that I was thinking while I was watching it, I was like, you know what? If I knew nothing about this character or this movie coming into it, it would be filled with so many more surprises, because it starts off as a space adventure. And then at some point, you know, she comes to Earth, and it's like the way the movie sets itself up in the beginning, you would not see that coming.
Right.
You know, right. I really don't think you would. So I think reactions would have been different if, you know, we didn't have like oversaturation of like all of the history of this character in the comics, in my opinion. What do you guys think about that?
I think with her, you know, like we mentioned earlier, she's on a journey of self-discovery and stuff throughout this film, and she's learning about herself. So when people are saying, oh, she's super powerful and not in any danger, well, at that point in the story, she doesn't know that, you know? You know, she's just learning as she goes, and, you know, she's not going to act the way I think they were expecting to see her on screen because, you know, she's not at that stage in her evolution.
Yeah. So let's finish the non-spoilery part with rating the movie. So how many Skrulls out of 10 would you give this movie, Jesse and then Jamie?
Skrulls out of 10? I'd go 7.
7 out of 10 Skrulls? Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Jamie?
Yeah, that's where I was leaning. I was leaning about a 7.
Okay. I give it more of a like a 7.5 to maybe an 8 because I have to say that the second time that I saw the movie, I actually liked it more, a little bit more. So yeah. I'm still kind of simmering on it, and I feel like I need to see it again. But I'm going to give it at least 7.5 Skrulls out of 10.
Nice.
Great.
Yeah, I'd like to see it again, and that might change the way I grow with it. But yeah, like I said, right now, good 7.
All right, well, that wraps up our non-spoiler discussion of Captain Marvel. Our next episode is going to feature a detailed and spoiler-heavy Captain Marvel review, so don't miss that. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about interstellar travel, because...
Woohoo!
Because why not? We're already talking about a movie where various alien races get around the galaxy via interstellar travel of one kind or another. So let's get into it. Basically, today, I wanted to talk about some more feasible options for traveling between the stars. We can also talk about some systems that are used in science fiction and how close to reality some of those may be.
I think, sadly for us, most of this may just be stuff we dream about, but we can talk about it all day.
Perhaps, but okay, let's start with the more realistic stuff then, because there are actually some realistic ways that with current technology that we could send crewed or uncrewed spacecraft to another star. Okay, so the first one, which is probably... the most likely option for anything that we might be using in the near future are solar sails, which you might have heard of. And the concept behind that is fairly simple. You have a sail, which would be like a very thin sort of material that's going to be super reflective, right? Like they'll coat it with sapphire, like a layer of, I'm sure that they're lab grown, you know, artificial sapphires. But basically, and this is then attached to whatever spacecraft you're talking about, and the idea behind it, how it generates thrust, is when light hits this highly reflective sail, when the photons bounce off of it, it actually does push the sail a little bit. It's not a huge amount, which is why any feasible use of a solar sail, you're going to have to use like high-powered lasers to push it. And even then, you have to have really large sails. And there was a sail, a solar sail, that was tested recently in cooperation with, I believe, it was the Planetary Society, Bill Nye's Planetary Society.
So you said it's driven by lasers?
By light. So when the photons strike and bounce off of the solar sail... You know, they lose, right. they impart some momentum to the sail. Which
okay,
in turn
just the ones, the, just the ones they've practiced with on Earth, they've used lasers to propel, not using lasers to actually propel something through space.
Well, that's the idea, and that's kind of what they were testing, although I think that they were testing it.
I guess it would have to be like lasers coming from a space station. You know, or something like that.
Well, it would either have, because the lasers planet. Are so, because the lasers are so powerful, you know, they're talking about maybe having them on the moon, right? And we can talk about that a little more. There was actually a book called Aurora by Kim Stanley Robinson, which is a great science fiction book about this ship that was made to journey to another star. I think it was Tau Ceti, to set up a colony there. And they used... in part, a solar sail, and I believe that the laser was mounted on Titan, Saturn's moon, Titan.
Right.
A hugely powerful laser. But so anyway, the Planetary Society's solar sail project was called Light Sail, and it was basically a solar sail attached to a CubeSat, and a CubeSat is just a very small satellite in Earth orbit, like very, very small cube, basically.
So like how big we talk? We talking like refrigerator size, truck sized, or because I know some of these satellites that are up in space are literally things you can carry around. You know,
so I mean they're very, very thin, so they fold up, right? But right. So let's see, they would be. There was a spacecraft called Cosmos 1, which was lost due to a Russian rocket failure in 2005. Now, that was a small solar sail intended only for a short mission. I'm reading from the Planetary Society's website now. Nonetheless, its sails were 10 stories tall, which is as high as the rocket that launched it. And if you look at a picture of it, it's like 8 triangular sails. About 15 meters or 49 feet in length, with a total surface area of about 6,500 square feet, which is about 1.5 times the size of a basketball court. And we're talking for a very small craft. So that was the one in 2005 that didn't actually get to do its thing because the rocket blew up or something.
And that was launched from Russia.
I believe it was. A lot of stuff is launched from Russia. I mean, between them and the United States, there ain't too many other countries that can launch these things. India being another one of them.
That's interesting.
In any case, so the sails have to be really big. And the way that they work is they slowly pick up speed, right?
Right.
From continuous use of the lasers. And the other thing is you'd have to have the lasers on the moon or wherever they are. You'd have to be able to aim them and adjust for, you know, the trajectory of
rotation and orbit
based on. Right. And the planets are going to be in different position all the time. So that's OK. So that's one thing. We've already spent a lot of time talking about solar sails. There's also like fusion propulsion. There was a project called Project Daedalus that was it was a study in the mid-70s, 73 to 78, by the British Interplanetary Society for a plausible unmanned interstellar craft. And what they were kind of designing for was a 50-year trip to Barnard's star, which I believe is the second closest star to us, the first closest being
Proxima Centauri.
Alpha Centauri, of course. Well, the Centauri system, it's a binary system, right? Proxima Centauri and Alpha Centauri. It was to go, this Project Daedalus was to go 12% the speed of light at its fastest. Now, get this, though. It was going to be a 54,000-ton craft, so it would have had to have been assembled in orbit. And 50,000 tons of that 54,000 was just fuel. And you get about 500 tons of scientific payload, and I guess the rest would just be infrastructure and things. It was propelled by a fusion rocket. Using pellets of deuterium helium-3 that would be ignited in reaction chamber. 250 of these pellets detonated per second, directed through a magnetic nozzle. The problem is this fusion technology is still in its infancy, right? And helium-3, which would be needed, is very rare. It would have to be harvested from, like, Jupiter's atmosphere with, like, a hot air balloon. There, I've seen concepts for a hot air balloon that would hang out in Jupiter's upper atmosphere and collect the helium-3, or maybe possibly mine it from the moon. So that's something that's not as feasible either. Now, the most feasible propulsion system right now that is totally available with current technology is nuclear propulsion. This was determined in Project Orion, which was studied starting around 1958 by Ted Taylor and Freeman Dyson, which is a name y'all might be familiar with because of the now famous Dyson sphere. But, I mean, it used technology that was available in the 1950s. And basically the idea is you have a ship with very good shock absorbers behind it, right? And shock absorbing plates, and what you do is you have these little nuclear bombs that nuclear bombs that are about the size of like a soda can, like a pop can, you know, like a Coke can.
Right.
And you shoot it out behind the ship and detonate it. And the force of that explosion hits the shock absorbing plates and pushes the ship forward. And, you know, you have tons of those. And that ship.
Because what could go wrong with a bunch of bombs inside a rocket going into orbit with 50. How many tons of fuel? 50,000 tons of fuel?
Well, that was the other ship. I mean, you'd have to take thousands of these little nuclear bombs, right? Probably, right. I mean, hundreds of times the amount of nuclear bombs that we currently have on Earth. I mean, they'd have to be different than, like, the nuclear warheads that we have now, too. But in any case, we know how to make nuclear bombs.
Yeah, we do.
And now we could probably make the ship a little bit better with today's materials and other technology, but the core mechanism that makes this nuclear propulsion work, you know, we know that it works, and it could take this ship that they designed in Project Orion up to about 10% light speed, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty fast.
That's fast. I mean, that makes it feasible to get from star to star. Now, we could get to Alpha Centauri in sort of a reasonable amount of time. There's still lots of problems with making sure that the ship remains habitable for humans the whole time and that sort of thing, and people need gravity, but that's not really what we're getting into here. But, like, if there was a cataclysm on the way that was going to wipe out all life on Earth, this is what we would have to use to save ourselves right now. And it would work.
We don't have that technology ready to go yet.
Well, we don't have the ship built, but all of the technology necessary to make such a ship has existed since the 1950s, at least.
Right.
Now, they stopped doing these tests because of the Partial Test Ban Treaty of 1963. So there hasn't been as much research on, you know, testing the nukes and all of that stuff. But this is something that I'm sure if the Earth was going to die imminently and everyone on it, I'm pretty sure we could make an exception and figure this out. Now, if we want to go to the MCU now we've seen in Guardians of the Galaxy, and I think maybe at least the first two Guardians of the Galaxy movies and possibly other movies, now we've seen them traveling from planet to planet, star to star, system to system, through, I guess they call them jump points. They're like those hexagonal, like, openings that they go through. And in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, there's that thing where they say, well, you shouldn't go through too many, you know, in such a short period of time, because that's bad for the body, but they do it anyways to get to Ego's planet. But that seems to me like a wormhole travel system.
Right.
Which in scientific,
they don't really explain how they do it, though. They don't get into the science or
not at all,
you know.
But I think in scientific parlance, that would be called an Einstein-Rosen bridge, and that is really all I know about it. That is really the domain of science fiction at this point. Also featured in Interstellar, I guess. Wormhole travel. Now,
and they do the classic explanation of wormhole travel by taking a piece of paper and folding it in half, putting a pencil through the paper, and then you have the two holes. So it's basically showing how it folds space so those two holes line up at the same time. I don't understand a whole lot about that. I mean, using the paper example says, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense. But actually,
they explain it in Interstellar in such a great way, because they do that same metaphor that you've seen in like a million TV shows and movies. Mm-hmm. But then they go on to explain, well, it's like, well, this is really just an analogy because we're talking about a two-dimensional piece of paper. What a real wormhole would look like is a sphere. And that's what it looks like in the movie. And they get into that. So that is actually, you know, interestingly for that movie, they did some physics modeling that they used to create the visual effects for the movie. Like, the visual effects for that movie spawned, like, groundbreaking papers both in like, visual effects technology, where there was, like, an academic paper about that and how they accomplished the visual effects for that movie, and, like, an astrophysics article, because they had to do some very crazy math, which I'm sure I do not understand, to model what would it actually look like to be this close to a black hole, and what would the accretion disk look like around it. And so when you're watching that movie Interstellar and you see that black hole, as far as we can determine, that is what it would look like.
And it's kind of like in the movies where, you know, someone dies and they go towards the light. We really can't film that, you know. We don't know exactly what it's going to look like, and it's kind of the way it is with all the space stuff. It's like, be interesting to actually see it in its form someday.
So we don't have a lot of time left, so there's just a couple other things that I wanted to mention. So people are working on this. I mean, you know, NASA might not have the funding that it needs to mount a, you know, a generational, you know, intensive study on how to achieve this this type of drive, but there are people working on this. So there is a project called the 100-Year Starship Project, which is a joint venture between DARPA and NASA, where they provide grants to a private entity. And the idea is within 100 years, we're going to develop the we're going to develop the technology required to create a starship that can really do international or interstellar travel. So there's also, everybody should who's interested in this sort of thing should look up the Tau Zero Foundation. That's the T-A-U space Zero Foundation. They're doing a lot of work on this. There's something called the EM Drive, which there's been a lot of hype about in like science news, which is a propulsion method that does not require fuel. It basically bounces microwaves around inside a bell-shaped container. These microwaves supposedly hit quantum size particles that are sort of coming in and out of existence at the quantum level of space to produce thrust. At least that's the working theory right now. Tests that even NASA's EagleWorks program has done on this have showed in a very preliminary way that it does seem to produce thrust against, like, against all knowledge that we have about physics. And those studies are not decisive. There's still a lot more work that needs to be done to see if it really works, how well it works, what's required to scale it up and all that. But that's one technology that's out there. One of the really cool things is there's something called the Alcubierre drive. And this guy Alcubierre was a physicist in France, I believe, who was inspired by the Star Trek warp drive. And he actually
wouldn't that be Alcubierre?
Perhaps, yeah, Alcubierre, and so I guess he worked out how you could actually warp. So the way that it works in theory is, you take the space, you create a bubble around the ship, right? A bubble of like empty space time, and in front of the ship you contract space, and behind the ship you expand space. So space is literally like pushing the ship through space at speeds that can exceed the speed of light because the ship itself is technically not traveling through space. So
that's
this,
crazy.
But the problem with this theory is, even though the math all worked out, you would need so much energy to make it work that it was, for all intents and purposes, impossible, because you would need as much energy as contained in like all the matter of Jupiter to actually make it work. But and you may have seen some of this concept art online of this ship that NASA conceived of, where it has like these two like oblong rings around it, and somebody determined that if you make the bubble around the ship shaped more like a football rather than totally spherical, it needs far less energy, and it might actually be feasible if we can figure out how to create the field and all of this other stuff. So that's something that's really interesting. NASA's Alcubierre drive, or Alcubierre drive, I don't know really how you pronounce that.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard of the weight calculation?
The weight calculation. Please explain.
Yeah, it was something that was, I'm not sure if he's a scientist or he is a guy that knows about interstellar travel. His name is Andrew Kennedy, and he came up with the weight calculation in 2006. And it's basically, they take into account the highest speed we've been able to travel, you know, as humans, or get something to travel, which is 240,000 kilometers per hour. And that was with the Helios 2 probe. I don't have the dates or anything on that right here, but basically that's traveling fast enough to circle the Earth in 10 minutes.
I think I have heard of this. I think what you're getting at is like, when does it make sense to launch
to leave the planet
to another star, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, they said at that speed, which is what we've been able to accomplish thus far, it would still take 19,000 years to reach Proxima Centauri. And for that, you would need a generation ship, which is a spaceship large enough to carry, you know, generation upon generation. You're looking at 19,000 years, that's 600 generations. So the weight calculation is basically, like you said, when's the best time to leave the planet? Because the theory is that you get in the ship and you take off, and then you finally reach the star you're getting to, and you find that it's already populated and filled with humans already.
Because it took so long to get there that back on Earth, we improved the technology to go way faster, right?
So there is a calculation. And 1,000 years of technology on Earth, we've come up with travel that's much faster. So you get there basically 18,000 years too late. And it's like, what's the point? You went through 600 generations of people on this ship. And then you realize you're late to the party.
There is a calculation that they've worked out where it's like once you get to a certain minimum speed, that's when you take off, because before then you're just going to get overtaken by later technology. But after then, you are still going fast enough that most likely you will not be overtaken. So it's that's part of it as well. Absolutely.
It's basically like driving to Best Buy and buying a new computer. By the time you get back home, there's a faster computer on sale at Best Buy.
that's the way it seems these days. Yeah, and you know, and let's face it, the distances between stars are vaster
astronomical,
vaster than you can imagine. Literally, I mean, it is so hard to wrap your head around these numbers. I mean, okay, the closest star in the Proxima system is about 4 light years away, right? Approximately, that is still the distance that light travels in 4 years, and light travels at over 186,000 miles a second. You know, it is literally the fastest thing there is. So that is a huge distance.
What is it for the light from the sun to reach the Earth?
About 8 minutes.
Yeah, 8 minutes.
About 8 minutes to get from the sun. Yeah, so if the sun exploded right now. And we're talking 4 years. If the sun exploded right now, we wouldn't know for 8 minutes.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, this is why.
And then we wouldn't care.
And so Alpha Centauri is about 4 light years away, and Barnard Star is, I think, about 6 light years away. And then a lot of the other, even with the exoplanets that Kepler has discovered that have a chance of having planets in the habitable zone, like a lot, like even the closest ones are mostly like about 20 light years away.
Right.
So this is something that we're going to need to solve eventually, but it's just fun to think about. I mean, you know, we love science fiction, so this is just fun to think about how these concepts and going to other planets. So that's just something that we wanted to follow up our
spacey talk stuff. And that's the thing too. It's like one of the things I regret about this life or the time I live and stuff is like all the stuff we're seeing on Star Trek and in Star Wars and all these sci-fi books. And you just imagine it would be so awesome to see it. And here we are in 2019 going, well, probably not going to get there in my lifetime.
I am still waiting on my flying car. I'm very disappointed that I don't have a flying car yet. But on the other hand, there are a lot of things that were science fiction previously but are now science fact. Like, for example, in Star Trek The Next Generation, they carried around those pads all the time, those little handheld computer things. Mm-hmm. Now we have iPads. Right? Now we have tablet computers. You know, there's so many examples like that. You know, back when Blade Runner was made and they're talking on those video phones, that was science fiction for the most part. You know, that wasn't like a commercially.
People couldn't even imagine that. That was so fantastic.
But now I have that
then
on my phone.
And now it's everywhere.
You know?
Right.
So anyway, I hope everybody, we're out of time for this episode. I hope everybody's enjoyed this talk, our non-spoilery Captain Marvel review, and just a little sci-fi interstellar talk along with some can we make it feasible talk. So that'll wrap up this episode. Now, tune in next time for our very spoiler-filled Captain Marvel review and discussion. And thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, we may not be able to explore space on the same spaceship, but we can do it together on this show. And thanks for listening. If you didn't catch it when I snuck it in earlier, you can follow us at Mecha Dragon Show on Twitter. And we look forward to seeing you there. Look to the stars, my friends. Good day.
Good day. And goodbye. Our music is Overworld by Kevin MacLeod from Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0, creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0.